Thank you, Mr. Henderson, and good afternoon to all. It's sunny right now. I'm not sure what it will be like by the time we leave here, if you've watched the weather forecasts a little bit, but at least we'll have a start. I did send out an email just a day or two ago to update you on my wife's condition. She certainly sends her regards to everybody. It was a little confusing coming in today because we've had so many people bring food over that I was bringing back the 47 bags full of dishes that belong to different people. That may be a slight exaggeration. And I had a panic-stricken moment when I saw one lady walk in thinking, I didn't bring anything back for her. And then I remembered, oh, that's right, the pumpkin pie is still in the pie dish. I've only eaten one piece. My wife had one piece, and there remain at least six. But then our son-in-law and daughter and two grandkids came this morning, so my son-in-law's here, so he can't be eating any pie as we speak. I'm not sure about my daughter, though. We'll see. But at any rate, thank you so much for all that so many of you have done. Certainly the cards are... closet door in our bedroom, which is sort of a base of operations for her now as she's getting a little bit more mobile. It's got cards taped up all over it, so she does appreciate that very much and knows that she's being thought of, and we do appreciate it so much. Thank you for all you do and for all your concern. It's very touching. We have now been home from the feast for a little over 2 weeks. October the 1st was the last great day this year, and today's date is October 20th. So almost 3 weeks since the last great day. It makes you think, on this Roman calendar date next year, October the 20th next year, we will just be getting ready to keep the last great day, because next year it will fall on October 21st, which will be a Monday on the calendar next year. So Sunday, October 20th next year will be day 7 of the feast. We'll still be there. I think it's a good thing if our minds work that way and are never far away from thinking about the beauty of God's perfect plan of salvation. It ought to be close to us always. We try throughout the year to keep focused on His purposes, but it's clear that He knew exactly what He was doing when He gave us those days to keep on an annual basis. The reminder is crucial. It's necessary. We are creatures of habit, and once we have settled into that particular habit, that's a good one, to be reminded every year and to look forward to them every year. For now, of course, we have a while before the next round of annual observances, as we know. We are entering that long wait, the period between the last great day and Passover. And because we have one of those extra month years on the Hebrew calendar this year, it'll be a little bit later next year. The holy days will be about 3 weeks later next year than they were this year on the Roman calendar. If you'll be patient with me today, I promise that you'll see how this is connected to where we're going today. I want to lead into our topic with a deeply thought-provoking passage from the first letter that the Apostle Peter wrote to the churches in his care. The whole letter is powerful, but there's one chapter alone which I think is almost like a roadmap to God's design and purpose for us as His children. And it's the second chapter of 1 Peter. Sometimes Bibles have subject headings. I know sometimes the various editions of Bibles that I've had over the years do have them. One of the ones I have at home, not the one I'm using today, but I checked another particular edition at home, and it has these subject headings for this chapter. It says, The Chosen Stone and His Chosen People. That's one heading that it gives. And that's for verses 4 to 10. You look at all that's in those verses, who and what Jesus Christ is, and who and what we should be. It's all there. Then it has the heading, Living Before the World, about verses 11 and 12. That's something you and I must not forget if we say we have love and concern for those God has not yet called. You heard Mr. Smith reference that in the opening prayer, that there are so many that God has not yet intervened to open their minds, but He will. That's in His perfect timetable. How will they view God's plan if you and I are the only vision they have in this life of what it should look like? That's important for us to think about. Submission to government is the next topic heading in this one edition of the Bible I have for verses 13 to 17. Following God's instruction and commands in this area is rapidly making us stand out more and more from the world around us. Some countries even have what they now call vilification laws. I don't know if you've heard of that, but if you speak about certain groups who have certain, let's say, propensities or tendencies or leanings in a certain direction, if you speak in a bad way about certain special interest groups, we might call it, you can be brought into court under the vilification laws of certain nations. And sometimes that clashes with what God's word says is an appropriate way to live our lives. And so we have to be a little bit careful in how we word things. It's kind of hard to preach a sermon from a jail cell. So we have to watch, even as we still speak firmly what God's truth is. As we know that our first allegiance is to the government of God, not to any government of this world, sometimes we're going to stand out more and more. There's a section in this Bible that says submission to masters, verses 18 to 25. That section includes the famous reminder that Jesus Christ is our example. Remember, the context is that he's our example in suffering, in everything, of course, by extension. This chapter alone, 1 Peter 2, could provide lots of material for study, for reflection, for meditation, for prayer, and for putting things into practice. Is there any one of us who couldn't stand to do it just a little bit better? I know I certainly could. To be more like the example that our Savior set. But I want you to take a look at the verses that begin this chapter, 1 Peter 2. What is the first word in 1 Peter 2? You know me by now, what that word means. Therefore. That always means because of what I already said. Do you understand what it means for you now? Therefore, because of the words in 1 Peter 1, laying aside all malice, all deceit or guile, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speaking, as newborn babes desire the pure milk of the word, that you may grow thereby. If indeed, it says, you have tasted that the Lord is gracious, coming to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You know, his focus, Peter's focus before he even gets into chapter 2, in the verses immediately before that, was to remind us of how temporary this human existence is, of just how fast it withers or falls away. He uses the seasonal nature of plant life to illustrate his point. Good time of the year for us to be aware of that. He talks about the grass withers and its flower falls away. Those of us who have, you know, relatively sizable lawns to cut, we look forward to that time when the grass withers sometimes. We say, okay, I get a bit of a break from cutting the grass for a few months. But it's seasonal, and we understand the point he's making. If you're like most in my neighborhood, you can see everybody sort of getting ready for winter around the neighborhood. They're cutting back garden growth, cutting it out, removing dead plants, trimming back some of the perennials in preparation for next spring's growth, starting to cut the lawns a little bit lower, perhaps to prevent the growth of any snow mold over the wintertime, although, of course, we expect a winter with little to no snow, right? Actually, I think we have a forecast of possible snow flurries tonight in some areas. flurries. You won't have to shovel it. Don't worry about it yet. But this is the time of year where we see the natural progression of the seasons into a kind of a time almost of hibernation. We understand the analogy he's making. When you read and digest these words, he tells us some things to think about. Verse 3 is especially interesting. If indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious, have we? Is that our experience? Do we look at God's way of life and say, this way is the only way to live? He tells us that we're supposed to learn these things because we've had this word preached to us as part of the gospel. The reminder to live obediently before God, remembering the limited time we have to do that. He uses the analogy of the grass withering and so on. We're supposed to get rid of things that just burden human beings and drag them down. Those things in verse 1. We're to get rid of things like malice, deceit, or guile, hypocrisy, envy, evil speaking. We just don't have time for that. Remember James's admonition about the tongue in James chapter 3. We desire the pure milk of the word, instruction, the basics of our calling. We have a brand new grandbaby at the house again for a few days. You know, she's between 3.5 and 4 months old now. When she's ready to take some nourishment, she lets you know about it. Are we that insistent about learning God's way? We should be. Is it our experience, verse 3, that living this way is a beautiful way to live? That God is gracious, He's merciful. Do we find it a joy to obey God? Is it something we truly want to do better, more perfectly every day? Do we, in the words of Ezekiel, even find ourselves sighing and crying over the abominations done in our world all around us? Do we ache for the time when all people will have the veil of understanding lifted? Again, I've remarked on the fact that Mr. Art Smith's opening prayer, he mentioned that very thing, about a time coming when everyone will understand. I'm sure we think about those things after having come home from the feast. Well, that's all the basis for what follows in this letter and in this chapter. And what follows has made me think about some things since the feast. I've been going over these areas, reading some of Peter's words again. It's now nearly a month ago since we started the feast. 4 weeks from tomorrow night will have been, 4 weeks ago, will have been the opening night of the feast. And I've been mulling over several things lately that all seem to tie together to me. I've been thinking about, for example, the example we set at the feast, before others who don't yet understand God's perfect and beautiful plan that's illustrated every year by these festivals. I was thinking about how long he's been working on this plan and his son Jesus Christ with him in perfect harmony and in agreement about what they're doing. I've thought about how many generations of the elect he has observed going through the time of their calling and their testing, staying faithful until their testing time is over. I've wondered about how many more generations there may be yet ahead who will illustrate the same pattern. I've wondered how they're all going to fit somehow into that temple that Paul talked about in Ephesians 2. He wrote to the church at Ephesus and talked about how they were all joined together. And he made the analogy or the allusion that it was not just that time then, but all of God's saints of all times. I've thought about what the building materials are called by God. He uses this term of living stones, for example, right here. And I found so much of it tied together in the next couple of verses. Coming to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. It's the living stones concept I want you to think about today. Christ is the living stone, the rock. But Peter tells us that we too are to be living stones because we're part of the building materials of that temple, that spiritual house that he's working with and building and constructing. And twice in this section, he uses the comparison of a priesthood. Once in verse 5, he calls it a holy priesthood. And once in verse 9, he calls it a royal priesthood. He says, you're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. I thought about some of those things in the last week or two. We're reminded of the fact that we're being formed into a body, a tool in God's hands. We can see that in some of Paul's letters too, like 1 Corinthians 10. What does that mean? What does it mean? That was one of the themes I've been thinking about and mulling over lately. Now, when I was thinking about all of it, I recalled a message that my wife and I heard nearly 4 years ago now at one of the Young Adult Leadership Weekend events. Maybe it was called to mind by listening to Mr. Horchak's In Accord this week. If you watched that in the last day or two, you remember that he gave an update on Hurricane Michael and even explained a little bit about the strength of the storm. But he also talked about the Winter Family Weekend coming up. And one of the things he mentioned was that there will be a segment in the Winter Family Weekend that incorporates the material from the Young Adult Leadership Weekend ideas into the WFW, the Winter Family Weekend. And it's done in such a way that it won't conflict with any of the other seminars or any of the sporting events, for that matter, that start on Sunday afternoon this year. So I've got thinking about that. I remembered something that Mr. Franks presented several years ago at one of those Young Adult Weekends. So I started digging through my notes to see if I could find it. And I did find it. I got out my old notes. I found the material. And sure enough, it covered some of the same stuff that I found fascinating and had been thinking about this week. It was all in there. And he took a unique approach in this material, so I was digesting that again, and I thought I would bring it to you today. It was from a presentation he made almost 4 years ago. And in going through it again, I was struck by how intriguing and unique it was. He was talking about church history, but with a difference. The reason it was so fascinating to me is it's not like we usually discuss our church history. There are about three ways, if we talk about this in a sermon or a study, there are about three ways that we usually cover it. Number one is we go through Revelation 2 and 3, the seven churches of Revelation. That's one way of approaching church history that certainly has some value. That's like a history of the New Testament church from Christ's day until now, or in some ways from Christ's time, the New Testament time, until his return between his two appearances. And you use Revelation 2 and 3. Sometimes we take an approach of much more recent history. We talk about the Church of God as we have known it and experienced it in the relatively modern era, going back, let's say, tops maybe 85, 90 years ago, to roughly the time of the conversion, the calling and the conversion of Herbert and Loma Armstrong in the late 1920s. We sometimes cover it from that perspective. Sometimes we get a lot more recent, and we'll talk about the last 25 to 30 years, which would allow most of us in this room to access it and have some memory of it, in which the core values and beliefs of the truth that we knew were compromised in the church body we were one time part of, and how the church as we knew it back then has been drastically changed in those last 2.5 to 3 decades. Now, all three of those views are helpful, and they can certainly add to our understanding. But as I discovered back in those old notes, I remembered there was something unique about it, and I found what it was. This was a fresh look. It was a kind of an in-between framework that gave me, at the time, a new way to think about and look at where we are in the church now and where we're going. And I think it's important we do that from time to time, where we are as God's people. I thought maybe today would be a good time to take a look at it as we head into one of those long wait time periods between annual holy days, and perhaps think about the passage of time in the church over a relatively short period of time in God's eyes. Not short in our eyes, because I'm talking about a period of time that's probably between 2 and 3 lifetimes for us. But in that presentation, Mr. Franks pointed out where society is church-wise. One of the things that has happened is that in the last 50 years, certainly, and probably 100 in other ways, in this country and in the world has turned against traditional religions. It's just not thought of in the same way as it was before. It's not even a kind of a cultural literacy. You know, if you were to say the phrase Daniel in the lion's den, for example, 50, 60, or 80 years ago, the average educated person would know exactly what you were talking about. That's not necessarily true anymore. I've used this as an example before, but tune in and watch the game show, the trivia show Jeopardy sometimes, and watch what happens when they get to a Bible-based category and look at some of the answers that are given. Some of them are wrong but thoughtful, if you know what I mean. You can see they're thinking on the right track, but they just don't have the idea. And some are just totally out to lunch. You wonder, where did that come from? There was one recently where it was... It was searching for a biblical character. They wanted the name of a certain biblical character, and this one person answered with the name Justinian. Justinian. Okay, he was a Roman emperor in about the 5th century A.D. I was really puzzling trying to figure out where that fit in as a character in the Bible. And the reason is people are biblically illiterate. They just don't know what God's word has. And so what's happened in our nation, that as a group we're becoming more and more secular, less and less religious. And of course, we understand that what passes for Christianity is actually a fatal blend of paganism and Christianity. We understand that. But even so, as people let go of anything that even resembles biblical principles, things deteriorate, as we know. We are in a place now where the average American, as I said, is biblically illiterate. Biblically illiterate. And the average age of many church congregations or church denominations is getting higher, is raising older and older and older. That's not particularly encouraging for the future of those groups. One statistic that I've found somewhat interesting lately in Church of God, a worldwide association, over the last several years, we've tried to estimate, and based on registration figures, what ages of the people are who are coming. And we have found pretty consistently for about the last 4, 5, 6 years that about 30% or just slightly less of our attendance at the feast is under the age of 30. Now, we look around us and we see the occasional gray hair in the audience. In my case, you just see the occasional hair. But we realize we're all aging, but we also have new ones coming up. Remember just last week, just last Sabbath in Akron, when we had the combined service, we had 7 babies blessed in the blessing of little children. That's interesting. You know, they just kept coming out from behind the curtain there. They just one after the other. And we've talked to a few other church areas where they had a nice little crop too, so that's good. But it's encouraging to see where we've been and where we're going. Church history is not always a matter of, is it there? You know, is the truth there? But instead, it's a matter of saying, well, where is it? Because Christ said he would build his church, and he said the gates of the grave would never prevail against it. So we ask, where is it? Maybe we have to ask another question. How much error can a historical body of believers have and still be the church of God? Because as you look back in history, it's hard to identify a church that has as much knowledge as we've been blessed with. That's maybe more crucial. I know Mr. Frank said that whenever he talks about church history, and he's done a lot of study into it, based especially in his time in New England where he had access to some amazing records, he actually was given access to Harvard University's library for his researches because he lived within a certain geographical distance of it. It was free to him. But the thing is, he's come to say, well, perhaps God's people were among this group. Among this group. Not this was the church, but God's people, they were among them. Because, of course, Paul wrote to Timothy that God knows who are his. 2 Timothy 2, verse 19. But back to the topic. You and I as a church have a history, and it affects us today. That's true of individuals and groups. One of the greatest difficulties in the church, ever since it was founded in AD 31, not just in relatively recent times, but ever since AD 31, is for God's people to try to set dates. Did you know that? Read the Apostle Paul's letters. In at least 2, we can find references to things like, we who are alive and remain when Jesus Christ returns. Isn't that setting dates? Certainly he was correlating it to his own physical lifespan and those of his audience. That's setting a date. We've done that. We see it often in church history. Of course, for God's people and a proper sense of urgency, I suppose there's a way in which it doesn't hurt to think we must be in the time of the end. And God's people have probably had that approach for a long time. In one biblical sense, if you look at Hebrews chapter 9, for example, Hebrews chapter 9, we read these words. Verse Verse 24, Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters the most holy place every year with the blood of another. He then would have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now, once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Did you catch that phrase? Once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. The writer of Hebrews, we presume it was probably Paul, but whoever it was, has made the comment that Jesus Christ's appearance, his first coming, in a way, could be said to be the start of the end of the ages. That's interesting, isn't it? And so God's people have always thought that, it appears. In one sense, the time of the end began with Christ's ministry and sacrifice, in one sense. But we in the church, as you know, have gotten a lot more specific than that. And in relatively recent times, those who've been in the church since the 1960s will know that one time we thought of the years 1972 and 1975 as very significant dates. Partly it was a mirroring in our minds of the first century church, which we could look back historically and see that they had these two 19-year time cycles, which is what the Hebrew calendar is based on. And we could see they had those 38 years to do their work from the time the church was founded in AD 31 until Jerusalem was attacked and razed to the ground by the Romans in the year to AD 69, 38 years. And so we thought, well, maybe it'll be just like that for us. There were certain patterns we thought we saw. Right at the end of the first 19-year time cycle back then, in about the year AD 50, Paul was called by God to take the gospel to Europe, to go across into Europe. Ironically, it happened in our own fledgling work that was going on for the first time, 19 years after it began. We were able to get on a radio station in Europe, and we thought, hey, that's cool. Look at that correlation. So there were reasons we thought that. The work of the church did have a massive push forward with that calling and ministry of the man named Herbert W. Armstrong. There can be no question about that. The Plain Truth magazine and World Tomorrow radio broadcast began in early 1934. You do the math. We thought maybe some prophecies of times of the Gentiles might point to some similar results from 34 to 72, we thought. That we were so well known, at one time I remember a political cartoon back when Jimmy Carter was president. He was named Man of the Year by Time magazine. In the city where we lived, I remember the political cartoonist drew a political cartoon that was to honor Jimmy Carter, and it picked three or four different magazines that were typical of certain genres. Time magazine as a news magazine. I think they even had, you know, Sports Illustrated for the Sportsman of the Year or something, and time, you know, Jimmy Carter's face was on that. But for the magazine to illustrate religious publications, they had a mock-up of The Plain Truth, Jimmy Carter, Saint of the Year. That's what it showed on this political cartoon. We were so well known that that political cartoonist picked that magazine to illustrate the genre of religious publications. That's how well known it was. Of course, that's all a moot point now. We can still look at some interesting scriptures. I'm not going to turn to all of them, but in Amos 8 and verse 11, it talks about a future time of a famine of the hearing of the word. Let me paraphrase what little kids say on a car trip. Are we there yet? I didn't paraphrase it. I quoted it exactly. It just applies in a different way. Jeremiah 30 and verse 7 talks about the time of Jacob's trouble and how it will be worse than any other time. Let me ask the question again. Are we there yet? In Matthew 9 and verse 37 and 38, we are told by Jesus Christ that sometime there will be people who will be searching and floundering around, and he compares them to being like a flock with no shepherds. Verse 36 of Matthew 9, when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them. They were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. Are we there yet? Does any of that mean that we are now moving through those church eras of Revelation, and so we had this massive burgeoning of awareness in the church, so we must all be Laodicean era now. Is that what that means? Well, it can't mean that we're all predetermined to be a certain kind of Christian, no matter how those church eras apply. There are those types among God's people all the time. One overarching lesson: it will never be easy to be a true Christian. It will never be easy to be a true Christian. Peter said in his second letter in 2 Peter 1:10 that some have given up their lives to make their calling and election sure. What about us? History, passing on the knowledge, is important. Israel was told to remember. Dr. Levy is going to be starting a section for the FI online in the book of Deuteronomy. When he gets up to chapter 32, there's a section in there that talks about how Israel is to remember everything that happened to them. To remember. The 78th Psalm, which we read from time to time, Israel was to pass on to the children of the next generations. They were to tell the children. That whole 78th Psalm recounts Israel's shortcomings in following God's way. You and I probably know that the most dramatic event of recent times on the church happened between 20 and 25 years ago. We would date it to approximately the mid-90s, approximately 94, 95. And while we don't want to constantly be living in the past, we need to be thinking about where we are now and where we go from here, and that's what I want the focus of this sermon to be. Still, we can learn. Israel was told to remember. We're supposed to, too. Paul said, we are the Israel of God. That was the time of the dissolution of the old worldwide church of God that most of us knew at one time. Most of us would say, that's where I came into the picture, somewhere in there, or my family did. Some people have characterized the time since then for the church of God as a whole as a time of kind of wandering in the wilderness. Well, there's a certain amount of truth to that. Back then, those of you who recall, feast attendance around the globe was somewhere around 150,000. At I don't know how many sites. It was really added up. I do remember one year when they had one of those productions from Pasadena headquarters. At the time, my wife and I were living in Regina, Saskatchewan, and that was one of the small feast sites in Canada they established. We only had 1,800 people there. It was one of the little feast sites. But they had a production that year that we were to play as a kind of an entertainment night, and they actually made a point of sending out greetings to every feast site in the world, and they forgot one. You guessed it. It's the one where we were. At the time, Mr. Dean Wilson, who was director of the Canadian work back then, was sitting right in front of me, and I heard him start to chuckle as he realized they'd gone through the whole list and named all but one of the Canadian sites, and they moved on to something else. Ah, well. Such is life. 150,000 people around the world. Now, I suspect, with all the groups that come together and that have a similar background in that, you know, the Worldwide Church of God, the total might be somewhere just north of 30,000, a little bit more than that perhaps, for all the groups together, 30 to 40. That surely is the most powerful recent event those of us in the church remember. But you know what? It's not the first time something like that happened. That's why I want to take an unusual look today. I was reminded of it by going back in my notes. I want to go back today about 175, 180 years in the history of the church. Now you might say, well, that's kind of a weird number to pick. Well, in a way it is, but in a way I hope you'll find it interesting. Like I said, we're not going all the way back to AD 31. We're not going to stop 80, 90 years ago with the development of the fledgling work that led to first what was called the Radio Church of God, then the Worldwide Church of God. We'll go back further than that, about twice that far, 175, 180 years back. That's going to take us, somewhere around the year 1840, give or take, to see our history as part of a flow of events. to get an idea of what it means to be living stones that God is working with. In some eras, he's putting a whole lot of stones in that building. And in other eras, there's just a little bit of a rock here and a rock there and a rock the other place. But he is building that building. Make no mistake. And you and I are being carefully measured as building blocks and as living stones to put in it. Remember the phrase that I gave from 2 Timothy 2:19 about God knows who are his. And the observation that Mr. Franks made, he always uses when he's talking historically, that he suspects the church of God was among them. That you find a group in history, you read about, and you see some of the identifying marks. You see some things that puzzle you. But that's where he looks at it and says, I suspect, based on some of the fruits that I'm reading about that are good, that God's people were among them. It's an interesting way to think about it. If you go back to about 1840, those of you who know your history will recognize the basic time frame. A man by the name of William Miller was a Baptist minister who kept Sunday, which would mean, of course, based on a very clear understanding given by 1 John 2, verses 3 and 4, that he was not converted. Because it says, he who says, I know him and keeps not his commandments is a liar and the truth is not in him. So he wasn't converted. He didn't have God's Spirit based on 1 John 2, 3 and 4. But God was beginning to stir up an awareness of something. Something was beginning. In fact, Pastor Miller, William Miller, did discover some interesting principles about prophecy. He was very big into prophecy. You ever knew of anybody else who was very big into prophecy? Yeah, we've had a few of those, haven't we? Namely, he discovered the day for a year principle. You know about that, based on Numbers 14:34 and Israel's 40 years wandering in the wilderness. It was a day for a year based on the 40 days that the spies spied out the land. Remember that? He discovered that. He stumbled across the prophetic principle of what we call type and antitype, how there can be a prior fulfillment and then a later fulfillment that is usually bigger and more pronounced than the first one. He discovered that. He understood something of 1 Peter 1 and verse 20, which says that the God's word, the scripture, is of no private interpretation. Now, he had some of his own, but at least he gave lip service to the idea that the Bible had to somehow interpret itself. You couldn't say, well, here's a passage from Herodotus, I'll apply it to the Bible. No, he realized the Bible had to interpret itself. He realized something of the fact that the Bible prophecies must have been part of a larger pattern, that in fact they must complement each other. That is, they add up to form a picture somehow of what God is doing. Now, here's where he began to reason. Here's where his thinking and his preaching went. He believed in the second coming of Christ. Do you know what that is technically called in theological terms? It's called the Advent. The Advent. So he believed in the second coming, or the Advent. He based his teachings on what he interpreted Daniel 8 and the prophecy in Daniel 8 to mean. That's the prophecy about the 2300 days, it's called. Actually, it should be understood to be 1150 days because it refers to the evening and the morning sacrifices. And it's a reference to the 2300 sacrifices that were made, and they were done twice a day, evening and morning. So it really should have only been 1150 days, or in prophecy and in fulfillment, 1150 years, right? But he thought it was 2300 years in fulfillment. So he began to think about things, and he picked on the year 457 BC. That was his own design. That was his choice. It was, in fact, a private interpretation. That was the year that the command to rebuild Jerusalem went out. It's referenced in Daniel 9, where the Persian ruler sent back some of the Jewish exiles to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. And the decree went out in the year 457 BC. So he began to get the idea that somehow The Advent would be 2,300 years after that event. And he preached that Jesus Christ would return in the year 1843, which that's what you get mathematically if you use principles of math, but not the calendar. I'll get to that in a moment. If you add 2300 to 457 BC, you come up with 1843 AD. People from many denominations, including the very small Sabbatarian Church of God, the Seventh-day Church of God, enlisted and believed the preaching of William Miller. A lot of people sold their worldly goods and they went out and waited for Jesus Christ to return. For some reason, he had calculated that it would be October the 22nd. I am not quite sure where he came up with that date. October, that's why I gave this sermon today, on October 20th. It was the closest Sabbath to... No, I didn't. But he thought it would be October 22nd, 1843, Jesus Christ would come back. But October 22nd, 1843 came and went. No Jesus Christ. So he went back to the drawing board and he discovered that he had made a mistake in calculations. He realized as he studied the Roman calendar that it has no year zero. If you look at the Roman calendar we use, if you're going from BC to AD, you're counting up BC 2, BC 1. The next year is not zero. There was no year zero. The next year after 1 BC is 1 AD. So you have to, if you're going from BC to AD, you got to make up for that extra year by adding it on at the end. So he realized, I made a mistake. He's going to come back October 22nd, 1844. So they all, I don't know what they did with all the goods they'd sold already, but people went out and they waited again in 1844. And you know what happened? Nothing. It was called in religious circles the Great Disappointment. The Great Disappointment. But there were a lot of people from the Church of God who had listened to his preaching. There was a teenage girl named Ellen Gould Harmon, who was one of them. In the year 1840, she had been 12 years old when she and her family began to listen to William Miller's preaching. By 1844, she was now 16. And she had a series of dreams or visions, she claimed. The ones that are usually talked about in the literature are the midnight cry vision. You know, at midnight a cry goes forth, the bridegroom comes. The bridegroom vision, related to that. And she had another one she called the new earth vision, I'm sure based on Revelation 21 and 22. In which she claimed that it had been revealed to her that the reference to cleansing the sanctuary in Daniel 8, which was where William Miller was getting his 2300 days and years thing, Daniel 8:14, she claimed that in her vision she was shown that it meant Jesus Christ was preparing for his saints a place in heaven and not on the earth. Now, of course, that's a problem when you read the rest of the Bible, isn't it? It came to be a sort of a rationale for people to try to explain the great disappointment of 1844. Shortly after that, in 1845, the next year, she met a man by the name of James White, who was a minister with sort of Millerite leanings. He was big into prophecy and that sort of thing as well. They married in August 1846, 2 months before Ellen G. Harmon. She became Ellen G. White before she turned 19 years old. By then, she was publicly proclaiming her visions. She was giving messages, giving talks, giving public lectures about these visions she'd had. By 1858, after they'd been married 12 years, James and Ellen G. White came into contact with some individuals who believed that the true day of worship should be on the seventh day Sabbath. Remember Mr. Franks's phrase about the Church of God was among them? And the Whites studied and agreed. And so they changed their practice of worshiping on Sunday. and they began to worship on Saturday. 5 years later, in 1863, James and Ellen G. White formally established what they called the Seventh-day Adventist Church. You can figure out how they got that name. They picked two of their prominent beliefs, a belief in the seventh-day Sabbath and a belief in the return of Jesus Christ, the Advent. So they called themselves Seventh-day Adventists. Some, though, who had been fellowshipping with them, resisted. They said that that was not right, that the Bible name for the church had to be the Church of God. And so those people also had a real problem with accepting the idea that Mrs. White's visions were being inspired by God. And so there came a parting of the ways. That small group that diverged down a different path from the Whites set up regional conferences across the country. And one of those conferences, the one that became the most influential, was established in a small town in Missouri known as Stanberry, Missouri. One of the prominent leaders that came to the forefront, prominent ministers, toward the end of the 19th century and the beginning years of the 20th, was Andrew N. Duggar. In his writings later, he recalled the period of time from 1905 to 1910 as a period in which there was a great debate among some of these people over whether the Church of God, this group that was now calling itself the Church of God, was entrusted with preaching the gospel to the world. There was a big debate, is the Church of God mission to preach the gospel message to the world? Now you and I would say, well, of course it is. This was a big debate in the church back then. This is long before the calling of Herbert W. Armstrong. In 1905, he was a 13-year-old boy. Andrew Duggar believed the church was given that mission. Others disagreed, and they claimed that the message was going to be preached what they called the third angel's message. The third angel's message is based on Revelation 14 and verse 9, where it says, the third angel sounded, and then follows an explanation of what's going to happen on the world scene. And so they called it the third angel's message. They said that's how this preaching would be done, some supernatural way. And this was the one that was sent by God to explain the mark of the beast, if you look in Revelation chapter 14. So that's where they got it. By 1925, Mr. Duggar was more convinced than ever that they needed to preach publicly about the return of Jesus Christ. But so many others fought him on it, and eventually he actually split off from that group known as the Church of God, and he moved to Jerusalem. He moved to Jerusalem in 1931, and he set up a separate organization. Now, that year is interesting. You see where I'm going back to show that there's a continuum and a flow to even where we have come from in the church. And in 1931, he moves to Jerusalem, severs himself from the Church of God, Stanberry, Missouri, and sets up another organization, also called the Church of God. I don't have the immediate details of what descriptive phrase was added to it. But a formal split finally occurred by 2 years later. By 1933, the separation was complete. But, interestingly enough, that was not the only split that happened in the organization. In the same year, 1933, a man by the name of Herbert Armstrong, who had been ordained in 1931 by the Church of God Seventh-day Stanberry, Missouri Conference, founded what was named the Radio Church of God. It was incorporated in 1933, the same year that the split finalized between Andrew Duggar and the Church of God at Stanberry. He had tried, Mr. Armstrong, for some time to convince the elders of the Stanberry organization that there was more truth that they also needed to preach. Not just the seventh-day Sabbath, not just the return of Christ even. But he pointed out that there needed to be an explanation of the annual festivals and holy days, which he was convinced God commanded to be kept. It was not just the Passover. The Church of God Seventh Day kept the Passover, but they didn't keep anything else. He tried to convince them you had to keep all seven. It was a package deal. He also believed that he had found in his studies and proven the identity of the descendants of the birthright tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, and that that would have a drastic implication on the world scene for prophecy. And he said, we need to preach that too. Interestingly enough, and you've probably read this in our own literature, that the leadership of the Church of God in Stanbury did acknowledge the probability in their view that he was correct. The reason they gave for not studying, they said they couldn't preach it, but that's maybe all we've known. The reason they gave, they stated they could not preach it because if they did, there would be even more splitting in the Church of God world. It's in the context of what had happened with Andrew Duggar. And so as a result of fear of further splits in the church, they refused to preach what they acknowledged was undoubtedly true. And where does that leave a person who's convinced of the truth? By 1946, at the Feast of Tabernacles, there was a huge grand total of 45 people who kept the Feast of Tabernacles who were part of the Radio Church of God. 45. That's 13 years after the foundation, the official incorporation of the legal body known at the time as the Radio Church of God. That's the only group that we know of which by that time was actively preaching and teaching and keeping all the annual holy days. They had yet to discover, and discovered right about that time, that the Feast of Tabernacles was a pilgrimage feast, in effect. You were supposed to go somewhere to keep it. That was discovered right about that time, a little bit later than that. So that toward the end of the 40s, beginning of the 50s, the feast began to be kept in designated locations. Herman Armstrong believed, as Andrew Duggar had, that the gospel of the kingdom must be preached. And if God began to call people based on his own experience with the small group he had in Oregon, he knew what had happened when he had left for a time period and left the group in charge of somebody else. He would come back and find that it had been split again. So he knew that there would need to be trained ministers to care for the new members. So he came up with a radical idea. He would found a college, a co-educational institution, not just men. In 1947, Ambassador College was founded. The first year, there were 8 faculty members and 4 students. That's a really great faculty-to-student ratio, wouldn't you say? Ministers were trained. Local congregations were formed. Growth came, and it took off in the late 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. But time moved along. Somewhere in there, most of us or our families came in contact with the truth. In my case, it was 1958 through my dad who first heard the radio broadcast. He and my mother were baptized in 1960. Very late in the summer, we were not able to travel to the feast that year. Our first Feast of Tabernacles was 1961 in Big Sandy, Texas. But Herbert Armstrong died in 1986. By then, we realized Christ was not going to return in 1975, since it was already 1986. And then came 1995, or thereabouts. Where are we today? Where is God's church today? You and I, we cannot duplicate the conditions of those massive growth years of the old WCG. That's principally because, number one, God has to draw to him to call people. John 6:44. We cannot go out and grow the church. Anybody who says they're going to grow the church is ignoring John 6:44. And I wonder what God thinks of that. In some ways, that time period was unusual. It was the age of the infancy of the impact of radio first. Look at some old movie stills or movie reels, movie shots of people gathered around their radio in the living room looking at it like they can see something. It was a piece of furniture in the house in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. And then there was television, a wondrous new invention that technically was around since the late 1920s, but finally became commercially viable in the late 40s and early 50s. And it was a conjunction of those, crashing of those ideas, the development of first radio that united the nation in many ways, and then television, along with, coupled with print media. You had to actually order a magazine or a booklet and have it mailed to you. And that's the time period that I referred to the political cartoon with the plain truth used as an example of the religious influence. We are now in another age of infancy in some ways. I would call it the age of the internet. We don't yet know where it will go, but we know that, like it says in Deuteronomy 32 and Psalm 78, we have to learn from the record of history. Remember Hebrews 9:26, that beginning with Christ's first coming, we have been since then at the time of the end of the ages. That's when the countdown to the time of the end began. In Daniel 8:19, there's a verse that talks about who appoints the times. It'll be no surprise to you to find out who it is. Daniel 8 and verse 19 says, "Look, I am making known to you," this is the angel talking to Daniel, "what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be." It's the vision of Daniel 8, the 2300 evenings and mornings. Who appoints those times? The Hebrew word for appointed time is the word moed, M-O-E-D. The same word is used to describe the holy days. Who appoints the timing of the holy days? In Daniel 11, verses 27 and 35, the same word is used again, moed in Hebrew. "Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but it will not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time." Moed. Verse 35, "Some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them, to purify them, to make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time." Who does that? Who does that? God knows. Remember what Jesus Christ said to his disciples? No man knows the day or the hour. You know, there's an interesting story in Jeremiah. I won't go back there now. It's during the time of the captivity of Judah. There was a false prophet who was prophesying back then. And he was going around saying, "In 2 years, we'll be back in Jerusalem. Everything will be great. It'll all be restored." And Jeremiah had been told by God it would be 70 years. So Jeremiah went head to head, wrote a letter to the false prophet in chapter 29. And Jeremiah told the people in chapter 29, he said, basically, do what you know to do. Live your lives. Marry. Have children. Live your lives. In 70 years, I will revisit and take you back. Do you know what happened to the prophet who said in 2 years things would be great? He was dead within a year. Who appoints the times? What do we need to do? Well, we need to apply some spiritual perspective. To do what you know to do, like Jeremiah wrote in chapter 29, build your houses, raise your families, plant your gardens. Do what you know to do. Or we might say, build your spiritual house, plant your spiritual garden, sow the seed of God's word, the gospel of the kingdom, and let him act on the minds that he chooses to act on. There are about four lessons I can think of we should draw from all of this. Once again, maybe we can ask, where are we in the flow of the history of God's church? The key is in doing what we know to do. Do you and I have a pretty good idea of what God would have us do? Well, based on Matthew, here's the first thing. There is never a time to stop preaching the gospel of the kingdom. There is never a time to stop preaching the gospel. Some groups in the Church of God world have decided in their own eyes, that it's time to stop preaching the gospel. They say, we just need to care for the church till Christ comes back. That's very short-sighted. Very short-sighted. Because you know what happens in time to people? I don't want to shock you, but they get old. It just happens. You wake up one morning and you say, I'm not 81 anymore. I guess. Haven't got there yet, but some people say that. I could ask my stepmom, I guess. She's 95. I should ask her, Mom, do you wake up in the mornings and say, I'm not 81 anymore? Maybe she does. There's never a time to stop preaching the gospel. Look at Matthew 24:14 and Matthew 28, verses 18 to 20. Second point, there is never a time to stop caring for the people God calls. Never a time. Matthew 28. Connected to those two points is an observation. We must not set dates. A handful of individuals who have ministries that call it the Church of God and came from our common background have actually set dates again. They've said specific things will happen on specific dates. That is a formula for disaster. Have we learned nothing? Believing we're in the time of the end is okay because based on Hebrews 9:26, we've been in the time of the end since Christ's ministry. But setting dates has never meant anything but trouble for God's people and His church. It ignores Christ's own words in Matthew 24:36 when He said, "My Father only knows." Third thing we can learn is guard the doctrines of God's word with diligence. That includes the name of the church, as we read about and heard about from history back in the 1860s. It's one of the signs. One of the signs, not the only one. Fourth point, pray for more laborers. Look at Matthew 9 and verse 35. Matthew 9:35, Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them because they were weary and scattered, like sheep having no shepherd. He said to his disciples, "The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Do we do that? He was moved with compassion for the multitudes because he said, they're weary, margin has harassed, and they're scattered like sheep without a shepherd. How would you describe our world? Weary, harassed, scattered? What was his view of what was there in front of them? A harvest is plentiful. There are, how many people in the world are there? 7.6, 7.7 billion? The laborers are few. His instruction about how to pray about it, he didn't say, pray that God will call more people. Maybe that's what we're doing. He said, pray that God will send more laborers. You have to have the laborers first. In our world, it's estimated as of June 30th this year that about 55% of the world's population has access to and at some level is using the internet. 55%. That's somewhere in the neighborhood of 4.2 billion people using the internet in our world. About 95% in North America, 85% in Europe, 36% of the population of Africa is using the internet. 49% in Asia, which means there are over 2 billion internet users on the continent of Asia. 2 billion. 67% in Latin America and the Caribbean. 64% in the Middle East. Oceania, Australia, 69%. The world as a whole, 55%. You know what that figure was 3.5 years ago? 40%. 3.5 years ago. The estimate in 2 years, 85%. From 55 to 85, it's estimated, in 2 years, we'll be using the internet. Where are the fields white to harvest? Every once in a while, I have somebody come up to me and say, we need a television program. I understand why they're saying that. They remember the heyday of the 60s. That's the technology of the past. We can do TV clips. We can do video clips. Guess where? On the internet. Where is the field white to harvest? There was some wise advice given over 100 years ago by President Theodore Roosevelt. He was talking about effective leadership. He said, do what you can with what you have where you are. That's not bad advice for any time, is it? Do what you can with what you have where you are. What are we doing in the church right now? We are doing what we can with what we have where we are. And we're praying, I hope, that God will send forth laborers into the harvest. We know that we're in the time that could be described as the end of the ages because Paul, whoever wrote Hebrews, said that in Hebrews 9:26. Beyond that, as generations of God's people have shown us by their zealous but misguided guesstimates, it's not wise to set dates. Christ's words in Matthew 24:36 are for us, but we can learn from some relatively recent history. God's church has gone through ups and downs, going clear back to the days of the earliest apostles, but it's true in the last 200 years as well. It's had occasional bursts of astonishing growth where those living stones were getting plunked onto the building right and left. And it's had times where there was just an occasional rock here and there. Who's building the building? Who decides how and when and who to call? One thing we know from history, when the gospel is preached, people are called. God knows the times, the method, the desire of his servants, and the way he wants to work. Pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into the harvest. Brethren, you and I must never stop. We are part of the living stones.